Fill to capacity. Crazy good stories and timely topics. Podcast for people too stubborn to quit and too creative not to make a difference. Inspiring, irreverent, and informative. Stay tuned. Hi, I'm Pat Benincasa, and welcome to Fill to Capacity. Today's episode, Creative Resilience, Rising from the Ashes. My guest is Jennifer Bichanich. Jennifer, did I say that right?
Perfect.
Thank you. Jennifer is a published writer, speaker, teacher, dreamer, dog lover, artist, and healer. As a tour guide of the heart, she facilitates deep-level healing through art, dreams, and intuition. Her workshops and spiritual life coaching help women who have been through tragic loss, such as the loss of a loved one, passion, or purpose, and help them discover how to find their bliss so that instead of giving up, they give life a second chance. Well, welcome, Jennifer. So nice to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Pat, for having me. It's such an honor to be on your show.
Thank you. I have been really looking forward to this conversation. So let's start. Everyone has turning point events in their life, something that happens and your life is never the same. Now, you've had your share of turning point events, but let's start with the fire. Can you tell us a bit about yourself before the fire, and what is the Bear's Grass Church?
Well, back around 2008 or so, when I was about to turn 40, I was working in a job for 15 years and realized that it just wasn't filling my heart with joy. So I just completely quit. No plan, just packed up my bags, headed east back to the family farm. And I started planting flowers because it made my heart happy. I just planted flowers. And one day I took my mom on a blueberry picking adventure. And on the way home, we drove by this little country church that had sat vacant for a number of years. And it had recently been sold to an architect. And I saw somebody standing outside. I said, "Mom, let's be neighborly and say hello." Turned my car around, got out, said, "Hi, I'm Jennifer." And that is where I met the boy next door, Blake Michael Bichanich. And romance quickly blossomed. 2 years later, we were married in that same little church. And I was at 43, I was a first-time bride. And this was better than any dream I could have dreamt. Blake was wonderful, wonderful, creative, talented man. He had this great sense of humor too. And we were living the dream. And part of my dream was to have more events at that church. My great-grandfather had been a minister there long before I was born. So it was in my DNA to care for that church and see it preserved. And about 2 years after we were married, we planned to have my nephew's wedding there. And the afternoon before the wedding, I was out running an errand, and I got a message from my sister. She called me, and she was crying. She said, "You have to come home. The church is on fire, and Blake is trapped inside." And I could not believe my ears. I rushed back, and it was too late. And I knew in my heart of hearts that he was gone. And I stood there in shock. I wanted to vomit, but I couldn't. I couldn't talk. I couldn't breathe. So, you know, I stood in a hayfield watching the church burn down. And it was like all my dreams were crashing to the ground. And it looked and felt like this big brick wall was going up around me, entombing my soul. Mm-hmm. And everything just went black. And following the fire, day after day, I went through there and I dug through the rubble, looking for my husband, my home, my memories. There were ashes like under my fingernails, up my nose and in my hair. And each night I'd go back to my mother's home and lay on my childhood bed and just stare at the ceiling, mm-hmm. praying for the pain to end. And it wasn't so much that I had a death wish, but I really had no life wish.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine anything else. Everything I had dreamed of was gone. This future I had planned with Blake was gone. And then one day, 79 days after the fire, I was laying on my bed, staring at the ceiling, and something shifted deep within my soul. And I had a vision. And in this vision, I saw this purple piece of paper unfold, and it read on there, "Jennifer, you have to try." And I got up off my bed and I got a yellow sticky note and I wrote on there, "I am loved." And I stuck it on my mirror and I kept on writing, "I believe, I forgive. God has great plans." And I knew even if I couldn't feel it at the time or see it,
yeah,
that it was true. And that's what I had hoped for. And then the final note that I wrote, and I just found this note recently, I'd forgotten that I wrote it, but I wrote, "I am following my bliss."
Whoa.
79 days after the fire, I made that statement.
You know, if I could jump in for a moment, when we talked on the phone and you were talking about this, you were talking about how you went back to the fire digging and you somehow wanted to find your husband. You wanted to find your home. You kept looking. And then you said something that was really interesting to me. Quote, "But you really never can recreate it the way it was, but you still can create something really beautiful out of the ashes." Jennifer, from everything you're saying, from that the dark of the darkest moments of your life, somehow you were able to connect with some sort of lifeline, cosmic, universe, God. Something got through to you and sent you a message.
Yeah.
And so when you said that you can still create something really beautiful out of the ashes, what did you build from the ashes? What did you do?
Well, you know, it's so true. I was just thinking this morning how chaos is really the beginning of creation. And so I just kept looking for light, looking for any little scrap, any little sign. One of the first things I saw following the fire was a piece of paper laying outside the church. And it said, "God is love, and he who dwelleth in love dwelleth in God and God in him." So that was really the starting point, was love. And just, I started small. At first, it was cleaning up, making sense, finding my flowers in the garden that were buried under the ashes. That first week, that was all that was on my mind. Find the flowers, dig out the flower garden. And my sister-in-law stood beside me and helped me dig. And just, she was a lifeline. She kept chatting. And it was like, I had one thing I could focus on. I wasn't thinking about, okay, what am I going to do next? So it started there and then it went out. When I finished cleaning up the ashes, then I went to our home in Minnesota, which had had water damage before Blake died. And I still had scaffolding up when he died. So I worked on that process. And when somebody dies, there's so much paperwork to do. So that took me a while. Paperwork, insurance claims from the fire. And about a year after the fire, when I was ready, there were three things I started that really helped me. One is I started working with an energy healer, a shamanic practitioner in Golden Valley. And that was amazing. Two, I started art therapy, which opened up this whole new world for me. I didn't realize I had all of this inside me. And three, I found community with Modern Widows Club. That's an organization that supports and mentors widows.
So this is really interesting to me. When something traumatic happens to us, we go through the motions of day-to-day life as if we're on automatic pilot, because frankly, I don't think we can handle anything else. And then eventually, slowly, and I want to be careful to say there is no time span on that, nor am I suggesting that ever about grief. But eventually, on our own timetable, we start to feel little things again. And maybe at that point, we create space for what we need. And coming back full circle to what you just said, it's interesting to me that you created space for art therapy, working with a shamanic practitioner, and then finding community in the Modern Widows Club. I wonder if someone would say to you, Jennifer, why weren't you rageful? Why weren't you pissed at God or the universe? How on earth were you able to look for flowers?
Oh, I was rageful. Okay. There was one night I woke up and I broke dishes in my shower.
Oh, okay.
But I put safety glasses on first.
Oh, wonderful.
I'm a cautious, rageful person.
That's wonderful. Okay. So let's start with working with the energy healer, the shamanic practitioner. How did you find this person? How did you even know to go to this person?
Well, I've known from early on that our body carries memories and trauma in it. My mom went back to school following my father's death. And in the 80s, she studied neuro-linguistic programming. And she was a marriage and family therapist. And with her training in NLP, neuro-linguistics, she could help clients get to the root of some of the things they were feeling. You could tap in and release that and reframe that. So I knew that there was deeper help for what I was feeling. Hmm. And one of the things this practitioner taught me about, his name is Ed, was the Chinese medicine clock and how at different times our energy is cycling through our body. So that waking up at 3 a.m., that's grief. You carry your lens in your grief, which made sense to me because after the fire, I walked around saying, I never knew my heart could hurt so much. And, you know, it was my chest. It physically hurt. It felt like, did you ever see Raiders of the Lost Ark? Mm-hmm. There's a scene where the bad guy rips the heart out of the other guy and he holds it up. That's what I felt like. My heart was ripped out of my chest and it was beating. And, you know, eventually with time that healed. But we do carry that. Our body remembers. So
yes. An interesting side note to that. As an artist, I work in a lot of different materials, steel, wood, glass. Well, materials have memory. So wood, if you soak it and try to form it, it has a memory. Steel has memory. So why is it such a leap to think our body, our muscle tissue has memory?
Yeah.
We carry that. So yeah. You started the work with the practitioner. And how did that lead to art therapy? How did you find that?
Well, I had gone in for my yearly physical and my doctor, the first thing she said is, do you want a prescription? I said, no, I don't want to do that right now. You know, there's a time and place for that for some people, but that wasn't for me. And then she said, well, would you like a recommendation for a therapist? I said, great. And they called, the clinic called me and said, what do you think of art therapy? I was like, oh, I didn't know there was such a thing. That sounds great. And it was just so amazing. I would go in and my therapist would say, well, what do you want to do today? And I'd be like, oh, I don't know, watercolors. I'm doing good today. And I'd start painting and 5 minutes later, the tears were rolling. Mm-hmm. It was like it bypassed that part of my brain that wanted to be all logical and explain it all. And I'm sure you can explain that much better, but it was just so powerful. And she taught me how to do art journaling. And with the images, it really helped me connect in with my intuition and with my writing. And I work a lot with images, with dreams. So it all just flowed together.
Did you find that you got some kind of relief in that practice by doing these things?
Oh, I did. I did. And actually, before I even started art therapy, I was introduced at a grief workshop to soul collage. And that is a process where you get a 5x8 card. It was developed by Sienna Frost out in California. And you get a card and then you give in a bunch of magazines and you just pick out a few images that you're drawn to and you make a collage and then you journal about it and let the images talk to you. Mm-hmm. And in this workshop, I got so excited. I was grabbing all these magazines. I had so much, I had to go sit on the floor and spread out. And I heard my 7-year-old self sitting in the living room alone in the dark after my father died. And I was saying, finally, I have a way to express myself.
Hmm.
And throughout this whole healing journey of losing my husband and the church, I came to realize that I had still been carrying 48 years of grief from losing my father. So that was the healing process along with healing everything. So, and that's something I learned is you really need to honor your grief, find a way to express it, whether it's art, baking, running, writing, you have to find a way to get it out of your body.
It sounds like you were willing to be reintroduced to yourself. It sounds like in this process, grief rips you wide open and there are these multiple selves before fire. Post fire, it's almost like, who am I? How do I know myself? How do I be in the world now? And it sounds like the therapy, the art therapy is so wonderful for things we can't put into words. An image, color, you know, the power of different colors we gravitate towards really tell a story in and of themselves. And it sounds like, wow, from the shaman practitioner, and then your journey takes you to art therapy, where you really acknowledge the loss of your dad. How old were you when he passed?
I just turned 7.
Okay, so there you are, this child, and children react in so many ways. Okay, I got to say this. I have this theory. We are all 4-year-olds on the playground of life. I don't care how old you are. At heart, we're still those children. And it's really a marvel to me that somehow in this art therapy process, you allowed that child to come forward, to feel her grief.
Fill to Capacity is brought to you by one of the most celebrated persons in history, Joan of Arc. How about carrying a bit of Joan's courage with you all the time? You can with the Joan of Arc Scroll Medal designed by award-winning artist Pat Benincasa. With loving attention to detail, Joan has banner in hand and is charging off the scroll-shaped medal with the words, "Be at my side." This beautiful brass alloy medal is ideal for holiday or special occasion gifts. Don't wait. Capture a bit of history and inspiration today. Visit www.patbenincasa-art.com. Now, back to the podcast.
Yeah. And I didn't realize how much of my life she had been saying she wanted out. Yeah. She wanted to express herself. You know, and like I said, with the fire, it was like this brick wall went up and there was no place else to turn. And I realized too how that loss so early on had played throughout my life, fear of doing things. And I was deathly afraid of getting married. And I didn't realize it, but I was afraid of being widowed like my mom was. And here I am standing in front of the fire. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm widowed. Here it is. Yeah. But the good news is I made it through. I found my way and I've come back to life.
Mm-hmm. So that brings me to how you sought out community, the Modern Widows Club. Can you talk about that?
I prayed for friendship because in moving back up to Minnesota full time, I really didn't know many people. My husband and I hadn't been married very long. And a woman came to inspect my work on the house because I said I was rebuilding it. And she invited me to her church. And I made a commitment that if somebody asked me to do something, I would do it. And I went. And there the pastor said, there's a woman in our congregation named Lynn. She runs a community called Modern Widows Club. Are you interested in connecting? I said, yes. And the moment I walked into her door at her house, I knew I was in the right place. And there's just something about being around people who have gone through a similar experience. You don't really have to even talk about it. You just know, you just understand. And it's okay to cry. It's okay to laugh. I think the first night I spent more time in the bathroom crying because I didn't want anybody to see me. But it's just such a wonderful, supportive community And we all need that community,
yeah,
that connection. And it really opened up a lot of doors for me. They are international now, and they do quite a bit to advocate for widows, not only here in the U.S., but around the world. And June 23rd is actually International Widows Day. So they'll be honoring that day next week.
Yeah. So you're active in the Modern Widows Club now?
Yes. I served as a leader for 5 years with them. And I recently stepped back with some of my duties so that I could focus on some other projects that I have been working on for quite some time.
So I'd like to segue in a little bit of a different direction. I'd like to talk about your brother, Howard. And it was really moving when we had talked on the phone. You said that you called your brother, Howard, quote, one of my greatest teachers after the fire. Who was Howard? Tell us about him. Why was he your greatest teacher?
My big brother, Howard, was about a year and a half older than me, and he was born with Down syndrome. And I always had a playmate growing up, and he just had a special way of looking at the world. Some people say people with Down syndrome have special needs. Our family felt he had special gifts. I called him my interdimensional DJ because he loved music. He'd play his radio while he's watching TV. And I remember this one time I was in my mom's kitchen. I was in my early 20s and I was bemoaning the fact that I don't have any money. And cue the interdimensional DJ, and he starts playing, "Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more." I'm like, yeah, exactly. I should have shoved my job. So he just had this wisdom about him and this cleverness. And the night of the fire, I retreated to my mom's house, and I was laying on the sofa and kind of going in and out of these crazy dreams. And at one point, he turned from his TV show, and he looked at me, he said, "Are you going to rebuild?" I said, "Do you think I should rebuild?" He said, "Yeah, you do that." I went back to watching TV. So I feel it's, you know, more than just rebuilding the church, but rebuilding my life. And I would come back to visit mom. I remember this other time I came back and he was at work and he got home and I was out in the garden. He saw me and he said, "You're home." And then he said, "My dear sister." And there was so much love in those words and on his face. And today would have been his 55th birthday. He he came to be a teacher for my family, I believe.
And what happened to Howard?
He passed away in November of 2020, and he had gotten COVID. And that was really, really tough because they would not let any of our family members be in the room with him. And as a disabled person with cognitive disabilities, he couldn't communicate like you and I can.
Yeah.
So, you know, we just kept praying and doing what we could to see him. And we finally, as someone suggested, we ask about hospice care, which then they released him right away. And we got him back home for the last 12 hours or so. And it was like he rallied when he was home, and our brother Stan walked in, and right away he stuck out his hand to shake his hand. And he saw my mom, and she was sitting by his bed, and he reached out his hand and patted her head like he always did after dinner. It was so sweet. One of the things Howard was so good at was speaking blessings. He loved to go to church, and he would sing his heart out with whatever lyrics came to mind. He didn't really read much. And one day I was just like, I gotta pay attention to what he's singing. He was singing, "God bless pop and cookies. God bless work on Monday. God bless mom." What would happen if we all went throughout our day blessing everything around us and everyone? What a difference that would make.
Oh, yes. It seems that Howard was a teacher for all of you in so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, you're no stranger to grief, the loss of your dad, your husband, your brother. And yet you said, quote, "There are many gifts that can be found in grief if you're open to receiving them." Whoa, Jennifer, can you say more about that?
Well, I think One of the biggest gifts that I got was finding myself. Like you said earlier, it's like you're looking for yourself when you go through an experience like this. And I did become this observer, and I got in the habit of taking these selfies when I cry, because I was like, who is this woman? Who is she that keeps crying all the time? And I had to really learn to love myself. You know, it says in scripture, people call it the golden rule, love God with all your heart and love your neighbor as yourself. We don't really talk much about that loving yourself part. And that really has to come first before you love your neighbor. Because when you love yourself, you have so much more love to give your neighbor. And you can see the beauty in your neighbor more easy when you love yourself. And I remember this one day, it was about 10 months after the fire, and my friend Maureen came to visit. And she got up before me and she did all my dishes. The windows were open. It smelled like lemons in the kitchen, and she was singing. And I walked out and I started crying because I was so touched by her actions. And then I started saying, you know, I'm such a loser. I can't get my dishes done. I can't get my paperwork done. And she said, hey, don't talk about my friend like that. And that stopped me in my tracks, because I wouldn't call her a loser. Why was I calling myself a loser?
Yeah.
So we really have to be a friend to ourselves and love ourselves.
And you said something that mirrors that sentiment. And it really hit me in our conversation. You said, quote, really sit with and honor that grief. And that was a big thing for me, because I was like, I shouldn't be crying every day. I should have everything done. And it's like, no. Take your time. Sit on the sofa. Eat all the potato chips you want. You have to honor the grief and work through it.
Yeah.
And that working through it, probably the most essential thing is the loving voice we use to talk to ourselves. And your friend, bless her heart. I mean, to say that to you, don't talk to my friend like that. And it makes me wonder how many times we talked like that to ourselves in that critical voice. And if we heard somebody talking to somebody like how we talk to ourselves in that voice, we'd probably butt in and say, wait a minute, like your friend did. Don't talk to my friend like that. So maybe that is honoring your grief in honoring and loving that tender soul inside of you.
Yeah, and just being gentle with yourself, and it's okay to grieve. It's okay to let it out. It's okay to stop and sit. And when you sit and you're still, that's when you start to notice the little pieces of beauty around you. I spent numerous hours down by the water throwing the ball for my dogs over and over and over. And they took such joy in just swimming and catching the ball. And I started to see just how beautiful it was to see the clouds reflected on the water and the sunlight, the way it would sparkle, especially in April when it's just, there's no leaves on the trees. You could see the lake and it was so gorgeous. And it's that being still. And then you start to hear the birds, but you have to be still. If you're constantly filling up your time, trying to fill that void, you miss it. So it's so important to just be still.
It sounds like in another way you're saying you can't outrun grief. I know, like if I'm working on something that's really uncomfortable or painful, sometimes I want to throw myself into more work and get into a frenetic pace. If I'm doing all these things, I don't allow myself to stop and feel what is going on. Yeah. And what you're saying, especially to someone who's newly grieving, it's okay to grieve as long as you need to. But that stillness, I mean, you're holding it up like a beautiful jewel. That stillness is something so beautiful. It's okay to hold it and to enter. It's okay.
Yeah. And you'd be surprised what you learn about yourself when you do hold it up and look at it. And when you can say, sometimes you have to say, what does this remind me of? And you start going backwards. And it's like, I like to think of, remember when you used to go to the circus and the clown would start pulling the scarf out of their sleeve? Yeah. It's like that. You start pulling it back and you go, oh, this is tied to it. And this is tied to it. This is tied to it. And then finally you realize it's tied to your heart. And there may be something way, way back that grief reminds you of. And you can now take this as an opportunity to heal and to get at that deep, deep grief. I know with my father, it was March 7th, 40 years after his death. And I sat at my desk and I watched the lake melt that day, the ice off the lake. And I realized that the lake, the ice melted on the edges and first, and then it went to the middle of the lake. And I realized that was like my grief. I had to take care of all that grief from the fire, from Blake, from the church, from the loss of my future. And then I got to what was really deep down with losing my father.
Yeah. As you've moved on in your life, and I'm careful to say moved on as if, oh, I'm done grieving. I do not mean that at all.
Right.
But as you've put one foot in front of the other in your life, what are the things that bring you joy?
I love people. I love being around people and helping other people. That brings me joy. I love being in the flower garden, getting my hands in the soil. Nature really inspires me. My pets bring me joy. And my dogs and my cats, they teach me how to play. Music, art, just being creative really brings me joy, and being with my family.
Yeah, sounds like it. As we wind down, I was thinking of Rumi, the poet, and he had a wonderful thing about, he had many things about grief. And the one that he said, your grief for what you've lost holds a mirror up to where you're bravely working. Expecting the worst, you look, and instead, here's the joyful face you've been wanting to see.
Wow. That's beautiful.
Jennifer, that's you. You are the joyful face.
Thank you, Pat.
In all of this, that's why I wanted you to come on today, just having you share your insights and your journey. One expression I love using, but man, does it fit you to a T. Iron will, tender heart. Jennifer, thank you for being
here. Thank you, Pat. Thank you. It was really an honor.
This is a story that will resonate with many people. And thank you for your generosity of spirit for sharing. So listeners, if you've enjoyed Fill to Capacity, please tell your friends, spread the word. And thank you for joining us. Bye.